We'll call the tax committee meeting to order. The first item on the agenda, members, this morning is House File 248, Representative Junkie, legislation dealing with Common School District 815, Princeburg. That might your bill might have adverse effects if Representative Rukavina, he's not a co-author, is he?
No, Evans, no.
Okay, good. Welcome to the committee, Representative Junkie. The chair moves House File 248.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I do have an amendment. I guess if you could move that to or get someone else to that gets the bill in the shape I need it in.
I will move the amendment H024A2.
And, Mr. Chair, what this does is really just make this bill identical to the bill that's moving in the Senate. It's really a lot of technical things, nothing of real substance, but it just makes them match up so we don't have to mess around with different bills coming out of each body.
Can we have someone from staff explain to us what this technical amendment does?
I see Tim Strom is here, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the Tax Committee, Mr. Strom. We know you spend most of your time hiding over there in K-12, but you get to spend a little time with us.
Mr. Chair, members, the amendment makes some technical changes, cleans up some grammatical issues with the bill draft as it was passed by the K-12 committee. There are no substantive changes in the amendment. The effective date on lines 8 and 9 is also a technical clarification, so there's no real effect except to clean up the language to the amendment.
Okay, with that explanation, all those who are in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those who are opposed, the amendment is adopted. Representative Junkie, to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with me today I have Bob Sporto, one of the members of the Citizens Group in the Princeburg School District, if there are any questions regarding the bill from that angle. I believe that Tom Melcher's in the audience also from the department to answer any questions you may have of them. Members, what this is, we've been through education finance with this. This bill was included last year in last year's tax bill. So for those of you on the committee, you may remember it, you have seen it. And basically what it does is allow the Princeburg School District to levy, an unequalized levy, by the way, no state dollars, to levy to pay off tuition debt of $282,000 owed to the McCray School District next door. If we would have passed this last year, what it did is required a vote of the people this fall on a referendum vote. Since it did not pass, Princeburg went ahead and took the vote ahead of time. So the referendum vote has already happened. The reason you're seeing the bill here today and not in the tax bill, members, is we're under a deadline of March 1st to get it off the governor's desk so it can be included in the spring tax statements down in Princeburg. That was part of the agreements that we made with the department and others to continue the District 815 in its present form and not dissolve it or continue to work on mergers. So that's why you're seeing it here. We are under some pressures there. The $282,000 that will be on the tax rolls that you'd be concerned about, again, number one, it's not equalized, so it's it only comes from the citizens out there. And number two, it'll be made in six equal payments to the McCray District after about a month after each tax collection is made in the year. The payments will be made to McCray. So 3 years of payments in six equal payments will be forthcoming. It's a five-year levy. After the payment to McCray is made, another part of this bill is paying for ongoing special education costs. Princeburg has no public school students, members. It's one of two districts in the state that has this uniqueness, but they do have special education costs that they take care of. That's about $38,000 or something ongoing, which will continue to be paid for the 5 years. Then they have to renew the referendum vote every 5 years if they want to continue in this manner.
So, Representative Junke, this is a purportedly a five-year fix. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Over the again, the first 3 years we'll be paying off the debt and paying the special education costs. The second 2 years, then it drops down just to the special education costs, and again continues to allow this district to operate as an individual District 815, individual school district within the state. I should mention, Representative Conan represents the McCray district along with me where the payments are being made, so he has some interest too. In case you got some questions you might want to ask Representative Conan.
So he's going to be voting yes today, is he?
I hope so. They're the ones getting the payment, Mr. Chair.
Okay, are there any questions by members? Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman, the Representative Junke, is this the bill that we talked about on the floor last year? Was one I forgot if we included it in
yep.
the omnibus tax bill or if I told you that in conference committee, when there was a conference committee, to be taken care of. Is this the identical bill or has it morphed and changed?
No, Mr. Chair and Representative Abrams, it's the identical bill with some moderation. We do know the dollar amount. We have settled that. That's in there. And the vote's already been taken, so, of course, the vote isn't required. But otherwise, it's exactly that bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Abrams.
Mr. Chairman and members, this came up rather late during the 2004 session, and Representative Junke was kind enough to bring it to my attention and former Representative Segrin's attention as kind of as unusual as it may seem. It is undoubtedly the right thing to do, and we ought to support Representative Junke and his efforts here and those in the Prinsburg and McCray school districts. It is the right thing to do.
Any other questions by members of the author or of the witness? Representative Simpson.
Just a question, and I think it's probably a fine bill. What's the purpose for continuing the school district if they don't have any system?
Mr. Chair, maybe if you'd allow my witness here to explain, why does Prinsburg want to remain a district?
You want to give us your name for the record, please?
Excuse me, my name is Bob Sportland. I'm just part of a concerned citizens group. I'm not part of the 815 board or anything. I was volunteered to come down here and just, you know, testify.
Thank you. Thank you for taking your time to come down and appear before us.
In Prinsburg, there is a private school, Central Christian, and that's where most of the kids, 75% of the kids in the district go to Central Christian, but District 815 offers special ed classes in a separate building across the street, so some of the students from Central attend the 815 special ed, and we feel it's a good program. A lot of the kids that have gone through it and the parents are very happy with it. We've had people even move into the district so they could go to our 815 special ed. And we would rather have the kids there than having to bus them, say, 10 miles or 20 miles. I know the McCray School Board President said last week when we were down here, he said, it makes more sense to have the kids educated there than spend an hour, hour and a half on the bus every day. And that's probably the big reason we want to keep the special ed program going in 815.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Is there anyone else in the audience who wants to testify either on behalf of House File 248 or in opposition to House File 248?
I just have one question.
Representative Abrams.
Chairman, Representative Junke, this probably has to start as a House file for a variety of reasons. Before it's taken up on the floor, could we get a commitment not only from you but also from Senator Johnson that this bill will only be used for the purpose intended, i.e. the Prinsburg School District, and we're not going to be getting a message from the Senate on this bill?
And, Mr. Chair, very good observation. In fact, I thought of that
same thing, it's a tax bill, so it probably has to be a House file. I know the Senate will probably have it up on the floor prior to when we get it there. This is so important that we're trying to meet this March 1st date. Any amendments or any change, Representative Abrams certainly would muck this up, and that is not our desire, and I certainly am committed to fight off all amendments from my side of the aisle. I can't speak for your side of the aisle. But
we can't either.
I'm glad, Representative Junkie, you speak for your side of the aisle. So. Okay, any further questions, any public comment to the legislation? If not, the chair renews his motion that House File 248 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. I'm sorry, as amended, we did add that amendment. So. Recommended pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. If no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those who are opposed, motion passes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Members, now we will revert back to House File 657. That is the technical and policy bill from the Department of Revenue. We will hopefully pick up where we left off last week on the overview of House File 657. Welcome back, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Rick Walzer. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue. And I will pick up with where we left off last Wednesday, and that's Article 6, the miscellaneous article. And I'm now talking about Section 8. This is a technical amendment that was in last year's bill. It amends the extension to file a Minnesota estate tax return from an extension based upon reasonable cause to an automatic extension as long as the extension is timely requested. Section 9, again, was in last year's bill, and this has to do with the calculation of the divorced spouse liability. And the amendment does two things. It says the calculation can only go back 6 years, and there's a $100 minimum liability before the calculation will be made. The next section is Section 10. Again, this was in last year's bill, and the amendment states that an order assessing tax can be sent by electronic mail to the taxpayer's electronic mailing address if this is what the taxpayer requests. The next section is new. It was not in last year's bill. This is the penalty for extended delinquency for taxpayers who have continuously failed to file their tax returns. Currently, the penalty is 5% of the unpaid tax for all tax types except sales and withholding. And in addition, for income tax, that same 5% penalty also applies. But for individual income tax, there's also a minimum penalty of $100. What this amendment does is make this penalty uniform for all tax types in Chapter 29A. So it'll be 5% of the unpaid tax or $100, whichever is greater. The next section is also a penalty provision. This provision was in last year's bill. It's a technical clarification which states that for purposes of the civil fraud penalty, the 50% penalty applies to someone who intentionally fails to file a return to the same extent as it would for someone who intentionally files a fraudulent return. The next section is also a penalty provision. This was not in last year's bill. This changes the standard for imposing the penalty for filing an incorrect withholding exemption certificate. This is where the employee is claiming how many withholding exemptions they're entitled to. The current standard is the penalty is imposed if the employee has reason to know that the certificate contains a materially incorrect statement, and that standard is being changed to where the employee has no reasonable basis for filing the statement, and this conforms to the federal standard.
Excuse me, Mr. Walzer, Representative Mulray.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to demean you that way. Mr. Rick, you're going to be sending these notices to the taxpayer's last email address, and that's sufficient to trigger all kinds of things. Is that,
Mr. Chair,
even if they're deceased?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mulray, the amendment adopts the provision that comes from the Minnesota Uniform Electronic Transactions Act. In other words, for us to do this, there has to be an agreement between us and the taxpayer to send an order of assessment electronically. So nothing will happen unless there's a prior request from the taxpayer to send it to their electronic address. No, we will not be sending it to taxpayers who have not requested us to do this.
Representative Mulray.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if the taxpayer has agreed to this and then dies, is whoever is appointed for his estate, it would seem to me, is then subject to this provisions, possible penalties, the assessment. And on top of that, you often have a replacement personal representative, and this is binding on them even though they may not have...
No. Mr. Chair, Representative Mulray, for a deceased taxpayer, you have, in essence, a new taxpayer, and that is the personal representative. If the personal representative wants us to send an order to them as personal representative to their electronic mailing address, then we will do so. But otherwise, you have a new taxpayer that steps into the shoes of the deceased taxpayer.
Representative Mulray, you...
Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to recall because I haven't done those for several years. You have income in respect to the decedent, which is normally filed on the individual's tax, I believe. So if the individual, when alive, had agreed to that on their income, wouldn't they be... I don't see how this would carry over, and what about I'm trying to think. Is there a separate taxpayer each time a substitute personal representative is appointed? I don't think so.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, if a taxpayer is deceased, they no longer have a last known address. The statute we're amending says that now we must be dealing with their personal representative, if there is one, and the same would hold true of a dissolved corporation. If we know that there's a successor, then that is the person that we are supposed to be dealing with. And again, if the successor says, I know that you're going to be issuing this tax order, I want you to send it to my email address, then we will do so.
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, that's assuming that they're going to contact you or even know that, but you said it's a new taxpayer, but it says it's sufficient even if the taxpayer is deceased.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mullery, as I indicated, the amendment doesn't apply unless the taxpayer knows that we are about to send out a tax order and they have requested us to send it to their email address. So even if the taxpayer is deceased, we would have to contact whoever the successor in interest is. If that happens to be the personal representative, they will know beforehand that we're going to be sending out a tax order, and we would have to have a request from them to send it to their email address.
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to hold up this time, but it doesn't seem to read the way that what they're saying is there.
Mr. Michael, you want to add anything at this point, or should we take this up at some later point? We'll take it up at some later point, Representative Mullery. So, let's. Just one other question, Mr. Walzer, on Section 13. You said that this parallels the standards in the for federal imposing federal penalties. How long has that federal penalty standard been in place?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to call Mr. John Haugen to the stand to answer that question.
Mr. Chairman, I'm John Haugen of the Department of Revenue. I can't give you an exact date, but it's been there for a long time. What we've run into is situations where you have what some people would call a tax protester. They put in an exemption certificate saying that they're exempt from Minnesota taxes for various and sundry bad reasons. Right now, the current standard for Minnesota, they would argue that, well, nobody told me I couldn't put in an exemption certificate. Nobody told me that I was subject to Minnesota tax, and I firmly believe that I'm not. Therefore, you can't assess me this penalty. With this language, since that taxpayer, when they put in their exemption certificate, didn't have any reasonable basis for their assertion that they were exempt, we could impose the penalty, and that's why we're proposing the change.
Okay. Representative Dabney, you have a question?
Unfortunately, back on the issue that Representative Mullery is on. May I?
Certainly, Representative Dabney.
Thank you. Representative Mullery and I were whispering before he began his line of questioning, and part of what sparked... I'm not sure if this is a question or a statement, but in the popular press recently, there's been stories of coming out of military family struggles where they've lost a family member in Iraq. They've then attempted to access that family member's email account And the ISPs in question have prohibited the family members from that access because it violates their privacy policies. And it struck me as I read this provision under Section 10 that very well may be the exact sort of person who requests the state deliver tax statements to them by email, a soldier posted overseas, because they're handling all of their business in that fashion, and yet now we're setting up a situation between the government and the ISP's privacy policy where the decedent's family and likely personal representative is unable to access their email accounts to access the tax statement. And I'm not sure if that's a statement or a question or just confusion on my part, but I see some concerns here given the current situation.
Mr. Welser, do you want to take one more trip around the block on this one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative, if I'm understanding you correctly, I believe if somebody is acting in behalf of a taxpayer who's in combat, so that if we are sending all tax notifications to the person who's acting in behalf of the soldier, then we would, and that person wants us to send it to their email address. That's what this amendment deals with.
Mr. Chair, may I clarify? The scenario that's been in the popular media would more be that the soldier is handling their own affairs, mm-hmm. dies in combat, and then the struggles that some of these military families have been facing is the inability to access the email account of the soldier who's died. And so if the soldier is handling their own affairs, has reasonably asked the state to provide them with statements electronically, but now the decedent's late soldier's family cannot access the email account, it seems like we've got a confusing situation given this amendment.
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, as I told Representative Mullery, once we learn that the taxpayer is deceased, that means there is now a successor in interest to that taxpayer, whether it's the personal representative or an heir or beneficiary, whatever. And that, in that case, we would be prohibited from sending anything to the taxpayer's last known address, whether it's their post office address or it's their email address. It doesn't make any difference. Once the taxpayer is deceased, there is a new successor in interest to that taxpayer. And their last known address, whether it's their postal address or their email address, now becomes irrelevant. That's the same answer I would give to Representative Mullery.
Okay. We can continue this later again if there are other questions, but let's continue, Mr. Walzer, then. I believe we're on Section 14, Article 6.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 14 is a technical amendment that was in last year's bill. It clarifies the definition of employer in the withholding tax law as someone who has merely legal control to someone who has just control over the payment of wages, so that the law will cover both actual or legal control. And this amendment conforms this withholding statute with the personal liability standard for imposing personal liability for trust fund taxes.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Greg Heck, and I'm with the department. I'll be going through the last five sections in this article. All five sections were included in the department's tax bill last year. Sections 15, 16, and 17 all relate to the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act. Section 15 relates to the annual certification. Current law provides that the land would be removed from the program If the annual certification is not filed timely, we're basically clarifying here that the commissioner will treat this as any other violation under that incentive act, and we would give notice to the taxpayer and give them a right to appeal the removal from the program. Section 16 relates to the length of the covenant. It clarifies that the land will be under the covenant for a minimum of 8 years. It also specifies how the four-year waiting period applies, and it also specifies when the covenant would end, when the land might be taken for eminent domain for public purposes. Section 17 relates to that taking of the land for public purposes by means of eminent domain, and specifies that that land would then be removed from the program, but only that portion of the land that is taken for eminent domain. The rest of the land would remain in the program. Section 18 relates to the Unfair Cigarette Sales Act, which is now administered by the Department of Commerce. It repeals the language relating to revocation of licenses, since those licenses are granted by the Commissioner of Revenue and don't fall under the authority of the Commerce Department. The last section, Section 19, relates to the Metropolitan Solid Waste Landfill Fee, and it basically clarifies that the penalties under that fee are the same penalties applied to the corporate tax, and this makes it synonymous now with the Hazardous Waste Generation Tax. That would be the end of Article 6 and conclusion of the bill.
Okay, thank you very much. Members, are there any provisions that you want to go back, have further discussion on? Representative Rukavina, did you want to go back to the taking away Christmas provisions? Not at this time, okay. Any other...
I think I'm out of the doghouse over in the governor's office, so I don't want to say anything back.
Have you formally announced you're running for the U.S. Senate yet, Representative Rukavina?
Not formally, Mr. Chair. When I get you on board, I will make that announcement.
I'm there for you, Representative Rukavina.
You always have been, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Abrams.
Is it possible to serve as governor of the state of Superior and a United States senator from Minnesota at the same time?
From Superior.
I think we'll have to check the Constitution, Representative Abrams. Okay, any further discussion on any portion of the department's bill regarding technical and policy changes, House File 657? Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just have a process question. If we have some articles or sections that we have further question or want removed, what is the best process? Should we come to you? Should we go through the department? Should we just offer up an amendment? What do you want to see?
At this point in time, we're going to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. So if you have proposals as far as either amendments or deletions or hopefully not too many additions, I would ask if you do have any of those, please forward them to the committee administrator. Okay? And then we'll take it up for discussion of those at a later date. So again, any changes, as I said, or deletions that you may want to recommend, please. It would probably be helpful if you would actually have them drafted in amendment form, so that it'll be easier to process that way, or easier to understand. As I said, if you have a proposed amendment for the bill, okay. Representative Dill.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I still have a question on that that fuel tax on the air ambulances. I haven't heard anything about the question I posed. But I wonder how they're going to figure that out. I mean, in trucking, they have dyed fuel, and the state patrol can test the fuel and see if they're running, you know, if it's illegal. In aviation, we don't have that, and further, I think that the air ambulances are licensed generically by the MnDOT, Office of Aeronautics, and so my analogy would be that a small air taxi operator in this state would be licensed as an air ambulance but flies multiple types of flights, corporate flights, and how are we going to figure out what flight? I mean, if I were running the air taxi operation, every flight would be an emergency.
You wouldn't do that, would you, Representative Dill?
Well, I mean, I'm flying, so that would maybe that makes it an emergency. But you understand the point I'm making. I'm wondering how that's going to play out. And then I was also wondering about the provider tax, if small air taxi operations that provide, and there are a lot, you know, mail, it just gets dozens and dozens a day of air taxi flights in there, so it does have some implication, just, for example, at Rochester. And I'm just wondering how they're going to make all this work, because I see it maybe being more of a problem than it's anticipated.
Good questions, Representative Dill. We have at least an attempt here to try to answer a couple of questions that Representative Dill has raised.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bill, I'm Mike Roloffs from the Department of Revenue. We do have an answer to the first question you raised about air ambulances, and I'm hoping maybe Pat Finnegan can help with the second one. Basically, you asked whether licensed ambulance services providers pay Minnesota care taxes, and a licensed, this was the answer that came back from our legal department. Licensed ambulance service is considered a health care provider and is subject to the provider tax set forth in Minnesota Statute 295.52, Subdivision 2. Volunteer ambulance services are not subject to the tax. According to the Minnesota Care Tax Division, 10 air ambulances file Minnesota care returns. Some of them are part of hospitals or other health care providers, and the tax is paid by these entities. Some receive the payments from other health care providers who pay the tax, thus they are not required to pay the taxes themselves. 45 other ambulance services are registered with Minnesota Care Tax Division, and the majority of these ambulance services pay tax. That's the answer we have. And on the last question about Minnesota care tax, and maybe if you would restate the new question.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Bill.
The thing that concerns me is that there are numerous licensed air taxi operators running air taxi flights for air ambulance. And if they are excluded in the tax on the fuel, the 5 cents per gallon, I'm anticipating that, as I stated earlier, that almost every flight will be an emergency because the operator will save 5 cents a gallon on the fuel. And how would the Department of Revenue propose to police that? And would the policing of that be more troublesome than the effort? You understand the question?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gill, my name is Pat Finnegan. If I understand the question, the way it works now for over the road ambulance services, they would have to apply for that. They'd pay the tax up front and then file a refund claim with the Petroleum Tax Division. So if this proposal were to become law, I would assume the same type of administration would occur, where an air ambulance service would have to file a refund with the department and submit some sort of evidence that the tax had been paid on aviation fuel that was used to provide air ambulance services. So they'd have to allocate the portion of the fuel to those flights.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dill.
So it would just be a good faith effort, because practically speaking, when you're operating an air taxi service and you do an air ambulance flight, the only way that anyone knows that it's an air ambulance flight is that when you file your flight plan with the FAA, you file in the remarks section lifeguard. So you're addressed as a lifeguard flight by the air route traffic control centers along your course of flight. And so I'm just saying that what evidence would there be to the department to know that these were either, otherwise you could be file as a lifeguard flight unless they came out and checked the card as a person, generally, I think, or a kidney or a heart or a spleen or some transplant organ. You might be hauling a load of freight for General Motors and then claiming the tax break. I'm just wondering what the connect is there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bill, I don't think we've reached that point yet, but it would be an evidentiary fact question where some type of evidence would be filed with the refund claim supporting that the fuel was used in that type of service.
Okay.
whether it's open to misuse, possibly.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I believe it would be like most other filings for refund, to use your terminology, that the first filing would probably be a good faith effort, saying, well, we use this much fuel. This is the amount that was related to specifically air ambulance type of flights. It would then be as a result of random audit or something like that, where the records would probably be checked in more detail. I'm sure the system would be set up somehow along those lines.
Thank you.
Another question, Representative Simpson.
Yes, under Section 43, I think it's on page 7, the electronic billing, filing of certificates of rent paid. We had some question on that about that time frame. The way I understand this thing and the way I think it was questioned is that basically after year 2008, anybody with fewer than 5 certificates will have to do this. Well, that'll actually be on like a duplex, the way this is written as I understand it.
Get some clarification again. I think Representative Simpson and Representative Mullery both brought up the issue of if you have perhaps a rental unit in a college town where you have perhaps turnover from semester to semester. Can you give us some idea of now who we're going to throw the broad net of electronic filing over?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative. In that section, there's kind of two issues here. Number one of them is about the low limit of the threshold, and we knew that 5 was an aggressive threshold. If that's too aggressive, then that's certainly something for the legislature to consider if they think that there's a better threshold. The second one about going based on the certificates of rent paid as opposed to the unit, the issue that was raised by Representative Mullery at the last hearing, in all honesty, we were unaware that the language had been written that way. It had been our intention all along that we were going to be focusing on the unit. What we're trying to get at here is to deal with landlords who renting property is their business, not the person who maybe owns one house, maybe two properties, something like that, maybe has some turnover. When Representative Mullery brought up the issue of the somebody who could possibly own one unit, and if they had tenant turnover that year, they might trigger that low level. That was never our intention, so we would try to fix the language along those lines.
Representative Mullery.
Mr. Chairman, as you know, I've already got an amendment in deleting the move down to 5 on that. But I think even someone with 5 units is, I mean, I know a lot of older people that have more than 5 units, and they are not in the business of being landlords, really, but they do have 5 rental units. And I just, even if you have 5 units, I think that's way too low. I think you're casting a broad net. But the other thing is, I went back and looked at the statistics you gave on who we're going to pick up, and it seems that you're not picking that many up, so why are we getting into the requirement? Unless you go down to the... I think you picked up a next... You, as I recall, you were under a few thousand until you got down to the 5 units, and then you picked up about another, and I don't have my notes here, but I think you picked up about another 20,000, was it, by going to the 15,000, by going to the 5 units, and if we're not going to go down that far, which I will, you know, I think there's quite a few people here very concerned about going after the mom and pop who have a
few units. If we're not going down that far, how much, it didn't sound like we're going to get much out of it by keeping it above 25 or whatever.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the numbers that we gave earlier was the first step would, it was our expectation that that would encompass 500 landlords, the second step 3,000, and the third step 10,000. So if we use the first step as an example, only affecting 500 landlords, but with the 100 or more property, what we would be talking about, there would be 50,000 CRPs filed electronically, and that's what the department really needs. That's the data resource for verification of people who file their renter credit electronically, which is now an option for them. So what we're really trying to do is get a data source electronically to help us make this movement that we're making with the other tax types in terms of electronic filing. That's our main goal on that.
Representative Miller.
I just want to follow up, Mr. Chairman, then with that information, I don't have an objection to, as long as you stay with the larger landowner.
I'm sorry, Representative Miller, you're saying, just for the edification of the members, what would your proposed amendment, what would you do, Representative Miller?
Well, Mr. Chairman, my proposed amendment would take out the drop from the 25 down to 5 so that it only pick up, except I think I would want to go to the 25 units, and I don't know what other members of the community feel, but I think people around a university could end up, even if you're doing 25 just of the forms, they could have two or three units and be picked up. I think if we went to the, and I know there's other members concerned about this, I think if we went to 25 units that they own, maybe that would, and maybe you should talk to members of the committee before you bring the bill up. But with me, at least, if it was 25 units, I think I probably wouldn't have a problem with it.
So, Mr. Roloff, we're going to have some additional discussion with some members about whether we're going to go by the actual certificate, or if we're going to go by units or something of that nature. Okay. Representative Brog.
Mr. Chair, I guess I would add to that, or whether we should do it at all to that discussion in terms of changing the burden from the renter specifically back onto the property owner.
You, Mr. Olson,
Mr. Chairman,
comment?
Representative Rod, certainly this is presented to you as a policy provision. We know that it does change burdens within the system. It's one that we think is we can make a good case for, but it's for the legislature consideration. So.
Okay, Representative Vanderveer.
Mr. Chair, it does seem as though the purpose of the people is to help the government agency. Is that the gist of this? Or maybe it should be the other way around.
You want to comment, Mr. Rolfs? Uh-oh, we're bringing in the heavies now. Representative Vanderveer sparked
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Jack Manson with the Department of Revenue. And I wanted to just talk a little bit about why we're doing this, and Representative Vanderveer, what we're experiencing is more and more taxpayers are filing their Minnesota income tax returns electronically. I think we're at 62%. Well, as they're doing that, they are also offered the option of filing their property tax refund also electronically. So, and also software vendors, and more them are also providing the option to file it electronically as well. So we're seeing an increase like almost a tripling from 03 to 04. So we're getting more and more electronic property tax refunds. And what we do currently is we compare a paper property tax refund that taxpayers file with us to the paper CRP. And what we're seeing is a lot of mistakes there, especially on the renter's end, because they, instead of using a percentage of rent, sometimes they include the whole rent or transposition errors, or also errors that are made from the landlord to the renter, too. So we are picking up errors, but if we've got an electronic return and there's no way for us to get an electronic CRP, we can't make that matching. And so it is becoming a bigger and bigger issue. I think last go-around we adjusted about 10,000 renter returns, and it was in combination with homeowner returns about $9 million in refunds, so that we adjusted. So it is becoming a bigger and bigger problem as we move to more and more e-filing. So that's why we're bringing it forward. And it does play in, it goes in with the rest of our mission to move from paper to electronic filing of returns and payments, and so that we can operate more efficiently and at a reduced cost.
For the edification of the committee, perhaps you could put together some detail again on how many currently you're receiving electronically, and also give us some information about those breakpoints that you have estimated as far as how many additional you would look to pick up with the existing language in the bill.
We can do that, Mr. Chairman, and we are open to a different threshold at the bottom, and also that we do tie it to the number of units rather than the certificates.
Okay. Is there any further discussion on this particular particular section? I believe we were on section page 7 of the summary, section 43. Any further discussion on this issue? Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you still on the issue we were just talking about? I'm sorry.
If you have other issues in the bill, bring them up now.
I just wanted to mention, if you were going to ask Mr. Manson to prepare some information about the item we were just talking about, is I think it would also be interesting to have him opine on whether, you know, depending who's included, who's more likely to be audited or not, and how the collection of these electronically affect which renters or which units tend to be at a higher likelihood to be end up audited.
You want him to opine on that now, or
sure,
do you want him to?
Sure. I thought you were moving on, though. Sorry.
No,
that.
We're not. As I said, Mr. Manson, you want Representative Lucheski to restate the question, or did you?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lucheski, the format by whether it comes on electronically or whether it comes on paper won't determine for us which property tax refunds are audited. This does provide us the opportunity to do that auditing, though, if we do have an electronic CRP. Without that, we can't do any auditing. As far as do we audit a larger units versus smaller units, that also doesn't matter as well, matter either, as far as I know anyway, and that it's really based on the individual filing, so rather than the landlord's number of units under them. So,
thank you.
And Mr. Manson, in this area, the what are your results showing in terms of those audits? What kind of compliance are you finding, and what level of perhaps undocumented or improper filings are you finding with the?
Mr. Chairman, the only information I have is that we did adjust 17,000 homeowner returns and about 10,000 renter returns for about $9 million in refunds. And I'm assuming that is from the last filing season. But I'm not sure of the compliance level. But I can look into that for you.
Again, maybe just in this whole area, if you could provide the committee with some further documentation as to you know, what the compliance levels are, and also with the information you have there, give us an idea of how many, you know, were over, how many under, so we can get an idea of what's happening in the entire area of the certificates of rent.
We can try and pull it together, Mr. Chair.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one quick question. When you talk about auditing, you also talked about verification. How many do you audit percentage-wise, and how many do you verify? Or are those the same thing with different terminology?
Mr. Chairman, the way I use them, it's the same thing. I'm not sure what percentage we do audit. We can also try and provide information to the committee as well.
Any further questions or discussions about certificates of rent? Okay, if not, are there any other sections of the bill that the committee or members want to discuss at this time? Any other issues to come before the committee? Yes, Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, if you're done with the technical bill portion, I just wanted to ask you from a process and planning standpoint what you have up your sleeve for the next couple weeks in February and March and kind of where we're going. I know streamlined sales, I think, is the next committee. I was just kind of thinking about the clock ticking down. And do you intend to have us actually vote on or review the governor's proposal, the tax bill that you've introduced for him, you know, spend some significant time on that in this committee, or will you be moving through an omnibus process and sooner as opposed to later? And lastly, I know you had mentioned to me, and I think I can speak for the minority in that you've been very willing to work with us, and you had solicited our input, and you were thinking at one point to ask all committee members kind of where they wanted to go and how they wanted to spend the time, and I don't know if you thought about that further and rejected it, or if you would like to get our input, and just kind of how you see things shaking out maybe over the next
year. Let me start with the easy ones first. Members, tomorrow we are going to have the department give us a presentation on streamlined sales. What I had discussed some time ago with Representative Lincheski is that going to give, rather than me trying to meet either with both caucuses or to meet with members individually to get your viewpoints and your ideas of what are the most important issues or how we should approach some of these topics this session, I'm going to provide all the members of the committee with a questionnaire, and filling out the questionnaire will hopefully give us a little guidance in some of those areas. In other words, I don't want to take a lot of committee time and spend a lot of effort on, the issue of foreign operating corporations, if that's not the overall will of the committee. The same would pertain to what are going to be at least a dozen or so other topics, obviously, that may be of concern or interest to committee members. So you'll be receiving that survey, hopefully, soon. I was going to try to whittle it down from about 6 or 7 pages to maybe about 5, so that you didn't have to spend too much time going through survey says type of information. Then to the next point, Representative Lucheski, we will have a presentation on the governor's budget and spend time going through the governor's proposal, and then we will hear other bills. Obviously, there are a number of the bills that have been introduced are dealing with property tax or local option sales taxes, which will be continue to refer those bills down to division, and they will be heard in Representative Vanderveer's division. And as soon as we think we are able, we will start then trying to hear other bills and work on assembling the omnibus bill. Any other questions from any committee members? If not, Representative Vanderveer, would you care to move the minutes from the February 9th meeting?
So moved.
We have the minutes February 9th meeting. Any additions, deletions, corrections? If not, all those in favor of the minutes as written, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those who are opposed? Minutes are adopted. Members, again, tomorrow we'll hear from the Department on Streamlined Sales. very important for us, I think, to understand this complex issue as we try to include this in our discussions for this session. So with that, meeting adjourned.